The next person that will be speaking is a first time, but her name is Heather Rice, and she is on staff with New Server Gospel Mission. And without any additional information, I'm going to let her come up and tell you about what she does, and she's going to speak to us at this time.
I have no boundaries.
If I can switch that on too.
Yeah. Put it on first. Well, technically challenged. Is that about a good thing? Somewhere I won't touch it. All right, well, good morning, first of all. And would somebody like to, or maybe just pass them around or hand these out? Okay, well, when Manny called me and asked if I would come and speak, he gave me this topic of mobilizing the church, the deaconhood of all believers. And did I switch this on, by the way, Walter? Do I need to switch? Do I need to turn it on? Or
did you switch it at all?
I didn't touch it.
I'm not getting it.
Okay, now are you getting it? Did I click it now? I switched it.
Two clicks. Just stay somewhere near the.
You got it.
Okay. Is that on now? Is that good?
It's on now. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Try this again. Okay, so the idea of mobilizing the church is kind of the basic idea that who is it that's called and responsible to do mercy ministry? Is it just deacons, church leaders, or is it basically every single believer alive? And I think the fact that you're even here and doing this means you probably agree with the latter, that it's not just the responsibility of deacons and those in vocational ministry, that it's actually the responsibility of every believer. And the question is, how do you motivate people in the church who have regular jobs and regular lives, who do church on Sunday and maybe even a home group and are involved with a few ministries? How do you motivate them to live a lifestyle of mercy, a lifestyle of loving others in a way that is tangible and practical? You know, how do you do that? And no expert at that, so it's kind of interesting for me to talk about it, but I certainly have lots of thoughts on it. And a couple things just right off the bat. There's two people in particular that I'm indebted to for my ideas on this. The first is Bob Emberger, who's the director of the mission. And everything I'm going to say about how to conceptualize living a life of mercy ministry, regardless of who you are, comes out of Bob's kind of mentoring me and the structure that he's taken that paradigm and created the mission to be. So that's number one from Bob. And the second thing actually isn't even from my church or my ministry. It's from Pastor Lou Centeno from the church that Walter's at, that I've seen happen in real life what it is that I'm going to talk about, where Pastor Lou has been able, by the grace of God, to begin with some challenging people and some very cooperative people and a mix of everyone in between to motivate people to do mercy ministry, to be involved in loving God and loving others in a very practical and tangible way. So if you have more thoughts about this that you'd like to explore with somebody, I'd encourage you to talk to Walter and to Pastor Lou, because he's done amazing things with a group of people that weren't necessarily looking to do amazing things. So anyhow, motivating the church. If you look at my outline here, I just got three main points. The first is motivating the church. The second would be equipping the church. The third would be cheering the church on. You know, how is it that we're going to scoop up people from the pews and get them doing this, get them living a life of mercy ministry, living a life of loving others?
How do you do it? And that this is what I want to talk about. And if you notice at all three points, kind of the little thing in italics there is about pointing to the cross. I think one of the things that sometimes trips us up is that we start thinking about it as being too complicated. We start thinking about, you know, doing mercy ministry as being a very specialized thing that you need special skills and special training for. And we kind of sometimes can get into a mindset of professionalism where you need all the right professionals to deal with all these distinct areas. And so we're just not necessarily all equipped to do what needs to be done in order to help people. And I would say to that, yeah, professionalism has its place, but it should never be a hindrance to us loving God and loving others. It's never a hindrance for you or myself or any other person in our churches effectively loving God and loving others. And if it is, then they're kind of missing the bigger picture. They're missing the fact that the cross really, really is sufficient for me to learn how to love others in a way that is helpful and practical and good in the way that God calls me to. So I guess I want to just set the backdrop for all of this as being, you know, hey, the gospel is simple. It's not simplistic, but it really is simple. And everything that I want to do in mercy ministry and loving others is going to flow directly out of the gospel. And if I lose sight of that, if I get entangled in all the rabbit trails and the complexities and the mess, and I get really, really confused, I need to just step back and just look at the cross again. Because the cross really, really does tell me how I can effectively love the most messy people in the world with the most complicated problems. So just keep that in mind as the backdrop of what I'm going to talk about. But number one, if you look at A, the cross compels us to drink deeply of God's love and grace. You know, there's no way on earth we're going to motivate people to do mercy ministry if they do not drink deeply of the grace and love of God. You see, everything that God calls us to do, it comes out of a heart that has been overwhelmed by, gripped by the love of God. If you look at, you know, the end of Ephesians 3, where Paul prays that prayer that, you know, based on everything that God has done for us in redeeming us, you know, the Father, he adopts and chooses the Son. He comes and he actually sheds his blood and does the redeeming work. And the Spirit, he comes and he seals. And then you have this doxology of the glory of Christ as he's seated above all power and dominions and authority, right? And then you go through chapter 2 where, you know, it says that, you know, look at redemption from the perspective of us being dead. And yet God reaches down and he makes us alive. He gives us life. And so at the end of that whole big thing, Paul prays that we would be rooted and grounded in the love of God, that we would know what we cannot know. We would know what can't be known. We would know the love that passes all understanding and knowledge. And he uses all these different metaphors, the rooted and grounded metaphor of a building, of like a foundation, the grounded one. You know, if you have a high rise, you better believe that there's a lot of building underground that you don't see for it to even be standing above ground, the foundation. The rooted metaphor of a tree. If you have a strong oak that's huge, there's a strong root system underneath that keeps it there. And so Paul's using all these metaphors to talk about the love of God and that it would surround us, that it would encompass us, that it would be the ground in which we're rooted, that when storms and trials and suffering and tribulation and hardship comes, we would stand firm in the midst of the storms and the wind and the complexities and the confusion, right? And so Paul does all this setting up in chapters 1 through 3. And then in chapter 4, he starts talking about what that means for how we interact with other people. And everything he says in 4 through 6 is based directly on what he's saying in 1 through 3. That because of the cross, we love others. Because of the cross, we forgive others. Because of the cross, we pursue the welfare of others. Because of the cross, we live out the gospel day in and day out to those who are believers and to those who are not. We live out the grace that God has demonstrated and poured out upon us to others. You know, if you think about it from another angle, it's like B under number one. It's no different than the first and second great commandments. You know, when the Pharisees are pressing Jesus on, you know, what's the most important law? You know, what is, of all the law that God has given us, what's the essential, most important one? And Jesus doesn't pick any single one of them. He just sums the whole thing up, right? That's where we get the first and second great commandments from. Love God and love others. The entire law, everything God has ever commanded us to do, hangs on those two things, loving God and loving others. So everything God commands us to do in ministering to those who are down and out, to those who are needy, to those who come to us desperately needing our help, who would fall into the category of what we want to term mercy ministry, All that is knowing how to wisely love others because of a love for God. See, because God has poured out his love on us and captured us with that love, that affects how we treat others. And so the more this becomes just the culture of how we think and how we interact, you know, in our Sunday school classes, in our home groups, in our churches, in our families, in our communities, if this is the conscious backdrop of how I treat you and how I pursue your welfare, how I think about loving you, then it's not such a stretch to push people to do mercy ministry. They may not know they're doing mercy ministry, right? They may not have a label or a title for it, but who cares about a label or a title, right? It's how we interact with other people. So number one, to motivate the church, it's not going to be by, you know, flashing big pictures of, you know, dirty, homeless women and kids on a screen, you know, and trying to do guilt manipulation, or it's not going to come by, you know, by trying to just overwhelm people with the need, because the need's always going to be there, right? You know, Jesus says you'll always have the poor with you. That's not going to go away this side of glory. So you could pour all of your resources out and become destitute yourself and not help everyone in the world. Jesus didn't heal everybody, right? When he came, he could have healed everybody, but he didn't. So it's not a matter of just saying you have to fix the problem of the world. No, it's a matter of how am I going to love God and how am I going to worship him by loving others? So that's got to be, it can't be a motivation of guilt. It can't be of God's done so much for you, so now what are you going to give him back? Those motivations wear real thin real fast. And you get compassion fatigue, or you just get tired, and you know, you just get tired of feeling guilty, so you get tired of helping people. If that's the motivation, it will never, ever, ever work. But on the positive side, there is nothing more powerful than a motivation of being absolutely gripped by the love, the mercy, the grace of God. And when we're gripped by that, it automatically affects how I treat you, how I talk to you, how I love you, how I pray for you, how I think about you. So if I am thinking in the context of loving God and loving others, then already my heart's ready to be taught and to be trained on what that looks like. Now, what does it look like to love somebody? That's a whole other story. I think there's lots of confusion in the church on that. You know, sometimes I think a lot of people assume that loving somebody means not confronting them, or loving somebody means not refusing something they're asking for. Sometimes we think loving somebody means just being, just kind of like doing whatever anybody wants from us in the name of loving them. And that is not the love that Jesus lived out. It's not the love he describes, and it's not the love that he calls us to. Love can actually be a very difficult thing to do. And so I think one of the things we need to do is we need to really start grappling seriously in Sunday school classes, in home groups, in church, in our churches, and in, you know, any context or sphere of ministry that we have or are part of, start grappling seriously with what does it mean to love others? What does love look like? And as we do that, that's going to determine, and that's going to kind of map out the plan of how it is we do mercy ministry, how it is that we you know, scoop up people from the pews to do it alongside of us, both in an informal context in their own lives and relationships, and in a formal context through the church. But it's got to be loving God and loving others. You know, just as an illustration, about 17 years ago, about 1989, at the Whosoever Gospel Mission, the program that exists today did not exist then at all. It had kind of over the kind of last 20, 30 years before 89, the mission had kind of dwindled down to just about nothing. There really was no program. It was basically just kind of a warehouse for people to just kind of stay, to the point where the director at that time really had a weird system of rules created so that he could keep certain people there so he could, like, run the store, run the bailing machine, or to clean. You know, it's like he would purposely not see somebody drinking so that they could stay, so he wouldn't lose a worker, just to keep the mission functioning and running. It was like a shell. It was a warehouse, and it you know, there was it was not a pretty sight. Well, the Lord brought Bob Emberger to the mission, and then soon after that, Ron Hammack, and one of the neat things that God did was God took Bob's doctoral work here at Westminster. and his sort of life at the mission at that point, which he kind of viewed as the armpit of Christian ministry, you know, because it was not a pretty place. He took those things, the Westminster Doctrine and the mission, and he just basically opened up a playground to teach Bob how to love God and love others and what that looks like in the context of a rescue mission. Now, a rescue mission, we're not talking about pretty people, right? We're talking about homeless men who have a whole host of complicated, complex, intertwined problems. Their life's like a twisted up, knotted up fishing line, that if it was your real fishing line, you just cut it off and throw it out, right? Because you don't untangle the mess. But since it's people, you can't exactly do that. So it was really, these guys were messy. And so stepping back and looking at the bigger picture and saying, how do we love God and love others? And what does it mean to love others? Well, simply speaking, what is it that I would want for myself? If I, you know, do I want to live in a decent neighborhood? Do I want to have a good school for my kids? Do I want to be able to walk outside at night and not be afraid that I'm going to get shot? Do I want to be able to have a good job where I can enjoy my career and earn a decent living? You know, do I want to, you know, if you just think of what are the normal things that you desire for your life and your family? So loving somebody else means, what can I do to pursue their welfare instead of mine? And when it comes down to the particulars, well, if I was in their situation, what is it that I would want for my family? What is it that would be good? What is it that they need? And then it's working to help them do that. So in the context of a rescue mission, loving God and loving others means that we have a learning center where we have two full-time teachers on staff that can help men work towards getting their GED. It can help them, you know, it just increase basic reading, writing, and math skills if the GED is not an option for them. It helps them, you know, write a resume and shape one that's truthful and honest, but yet doesn't, you know, kill them before they walk in the door because they had to explain why they, you know, were in prison for 10 years. But hey, if you can talk about how they were a line cook and learn how to please very unhappy customers, that's a pretty good trait, right? That might be transferable to a job, you know? And like, how do you, that's loving somebody in a very practical, down-to-earth way. So you know, if somebody comes to you with a really kind of complicated situation, yeah, it's going to be maybe hard to kind of untangle it and figure out what are the main issues here and what's going on. But the motivation is, God loves me. I love God, and I love others. How is it that I'm going to love this person? Now, I may need help on figuring out what that looks like in this case, but that's my absolute rock-bottom motivation. And it gives me a framework to start from. It gives me a place to start. So that's number one. I think we need to motivate the church by just not only helping them to see that the love of God shapes how I'm going to love God and love others, but also what does that look like? What does that look like? You know, love is not just a kind of wimpy, mamby-pamby kind of thing that just does what you ask me to do. It's pursuing your welfare even when you don't really want me to. That is what love is. And so learning and teaching and just exploring what that looks like, I think that is absolutely essential to motivating the church to be able to do mercy ministry without even calling it mercy ministry, to be able to do the Christian life of loving God and loving others. You know, just scriptures that you can explore and look at and even explore with any group that you're working with or teaching. You know, you have Matthew 22, right, with the first and second great commandments, especially, you know, 34 to 40 in Matthew 22, where Jesus sums up the whole law, you know, loving God and loving others. Everything he's called us to do is summed in loving God and loving others. And then you can even skip forward to Matthew 28, which, you know, we all know is the Great Commission. But what is it that God is calling us there to do? He's calling us to teach and disciple those who are saved to do everything that God's commanded us to do. Well, how did God just sum up everything he's commanded us to do? Loving God and loving others. So an essential part of the Great Commission is teaching people, teaching the church, to love God and love others. The Great Commission is left undone if we stop before that point. So teaching the church and motivating the church to do mercy ministry is a part of the Great Commission. So you can explore that. You can explore the whole book of Ephesians, you know. It's only 6 chapters. You got the first 3 talking about the motivations, the why. The second 3 talking about the what. What does it look like to love God and love others? And it gets very practical.
to relationships between husband and wife, you know, parent and child, employer and employee, strangers, again, it's you know, enemies, friends. It talks about how what it looks like to love God and love others in relationship. You can look at the whole book of Romans, right? It's kind of like the same concept of Ephesians, only a lot more spelled out, a lot more detailed. It's the same point, the same gospel, even the same guy who wrote it. So that's number one, motivating the church, pointing to the cross. It's got to be rooted in the cross. Okay, but you can't just point them there and motivate them and just leave them out there hanging and say, just go do it, go love people. Well, what does that mean? You know, what does it look like? Granted, you know, we're to be wise as a serpent, but gentle as a dove. Well, how do people grow in being wise without help, without guidance? And that's where I think it is the responsibility of the church, of the leadership, to train believers on what does it look like to love others in a wise way. You know, so that you're not just enabling people, you're not just sort of doing things that sort of soothe your conscience. You know, it's not just like you're going downtown and feeding people and soothing your conscience and then, you know, going back to your suburban life and saying, well, I do mercy ministry. Well, no, okay, how do we take that desire to love God and love others and help people work it out in a way that is effective, that is wise? Just as a side note, wisdom definitely needs to be a part of how we do mercy ministry, but it's not, how should I say it? If you do something completely unwise, you have not sinned. The person doing it has sinned. So if you are helping someone and you realize you haven't necessarily done it the wisest way, and you probably realize it because it all comes out in the end and you realize you were kind of foolish in what you did, you are not the one who did wrong. It is always better to err on the side of grace. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with not knowing whether something is legitimate or not and choosing to assist anyway. There's nothing sinful about that. If you're going to err, there's nothing evil about erring on the side of grace. Just as a side note. It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. But anyway. Equipping the church. Keep on pointing to the cross. You're going to equip them the same way you've motivated them. You're going to equip them by pointing them back to the cross, because the cross tells me what it looks like to love my neighbor. How is it that Jesus demonstrated his love to us? Well, Romans 5:8, he demonstrated it by the cross. Now, what happened at the cross? Christ considered my welfare above his own. He sought my welfare at great risk to himself. You know, sometimes when we consider whether or not a particular, you know, ministry is worth it for us, we often consider the risk involved. And if there is a risk involved, we often say, that's not for me because that might hurt my family. Or that's not for me because, you know, this might happen. Now, I'm not saying, there's no cut and dried answer to say, you know, that you need to do it or not. There's certainly nothing that says you should pursue damage and hurt and risk. However, risk is not something that can ever determine that I shouldn't do it. Because the gospel's risky. The cross was risky. It doesn't get much more risky than actually being crucified and dying. It's hard to get more risky than that. You know? So just because there's a risk involved doesn't mean I shouldn't do it. The cross is also very inconvenient, right? Talk about disrupting my life schedule. And you know, being completely an unhappy experience, right? Just because there would be suffering involved doesn't mean I don't do it. You know, so the cross really is going to define for me what love looks like and what love is, and it's not always a pretty picture. You know, sometimes we can tend to place too much of a premium on our own comfort, on our own even safety, and not be willing to take a risk to love others. You know, this is just sort of a small example, because I don't really think there's any risk involved. But when I, okay, at the mission, we're opening up a program for women with young children. Well, and we actually have our zoning hearing this Wednesday, finally, after 2 years of waiting for it. But in order to kind of help build relationship with the neighbors and get this zoning process moving,
we realized that we really needed to move in and make friends with the neighbors. And that meant renting one of the houses from the church that currently owns the property and me moving in there to try to build a relationship and make friends with the neighbors. Now, it's only Olney, okay? It's not like it's not the Badlands, you know? It's not a bad neighborhood at all. And you know, living by myself is not a big deal. Big empty house sometimes, granted, but I see nothing inherently risky or dangerous about it. However, my church was horrified that I would move in by myself and do it. And I guess bigger than the issue of trying to convince them that this really isn't a bad neighborhood and it really isn't dangerous to do, to me that's actually irrelevant, because if it was a bad neighborhood and it was dangerous to do, I don't think it wouldn't have changed my mind anyway on whether or not it needed to be done. Because the question becomes, is God, I mean, I believe he's sovereign, but do I really believe he's in control? You know, we can have all our theology right in a kind of theoretical way, but functionally our theology could really stink, right? You know, I believe he's sovereign, but do I really believe he's in control? And if I do, then why am I so afraid of taking a risk? Because if God calls me to do this, I mean, okay, the early church and from the apostles on down through the centuries, there was lots of risk involved, and there was lots of pain and suffering involved. There was even lots of death involved. So I think part of the barriers to doing mercy ministry in our church, in our world, is this kind of Western concept of my rights, my boundaries, my safety, my comfort. And that, I think we need to be careful and evaluate how much of that is biblical and how much of it really is just a cultural thing that says my health and safety come first. I'm not saying you pursue, danger and you look for it, but I'm saying if that's a factor, that should not automatically tell me, no, I'm not going to do it. And because the cross is risky. So how else do we equip the church? Well, mercy ministry really is just loving others. We've talked about that quite a bit. In other words, it's not complicated. It really isn't. It's complex sometimes, and you need a lot of help sometimes, but it's really not complicated. B, under number two, because of the cross, we have all the resources we need to effectively love others. You know, sometimes we can doubt that. You know, sometimes we can talk with somebody and think, man, their problems are so far beyond what I even know how to handle. Let's just send them to a professional, or let's just, you know, pass them off to someone else. And I think that we need to take Scripture seriously when he tells us that, you know, we have everything we need for life and for godliness. And part of life and godliness is me being called to love God and love others. And therefore, I really am equipped with everything I need to love others. Now, everything I need may involve the resources of the church at large. It may, you know, it's going to involve other people. I am not a lone ranger. But we really do have everything we need to do it. Okay, that's one thing. You know, I think part of the challenge with the church is convincing them that they really are confident and equipped to do this. That they really do have the resources they need to do it effectively. You have all the resources of Scripture. Now, this might be more on the counseling side and the helping others through their problems as you counsel them while you're, you know, helping them, like the gospel show and tell, not just doing things, but also walking alongside and helping them to reinterpret life and to see, to put on different glasses and to change their view of life from just this myopic, narrow little view of their problems to the view of the bigger picture, that God really is king, and that, you know, things came from somewhere and they're going somewhere, namely the kingdom of God is alive and well, and the cross, you know, the shadow of the cross changes the way we look at life, and it certainly gives us a point to look forward to, that all of creation is actually going somewhere. People don't see that when they're in the midst of their problems, and part of doing mercy ministry is not just doing the physical deeds, but coming alongside and helping them to reinterpret life and to interpret what's happening through the eyes of God and His Word. And we really do have what we need to do that. You know, Scripture is powerful. It understands people to the core, motivations, heart issues, struggles. it understands us to the core. You know, you just read you know, 2 Timothy 3:16 and you know, Hebrews, where it talks about in chapter 4, where he talks about, you know, that you know, the Word of God is living and active, and it's sharp, and it pierces us. You know, it divides between motivations and thought. I mean, it gets to the core, and it basically says that it just lays us bare before God. And that's the tool that we have, you know. That's the tool that we have. And also, the very power that raised Christ from the dead and seated him above all powers and principalities and kingdoms, that's the power working in us to do ministry. And it's not just us, it's not just leaders, it's every single believer. That power is at the disposal of every single believer. So they really do have what they need. Convincing them that they have what they need may be another story. But we do. We are equipped. Every believer is equipped. You know, tips for sorting through the complexities. Letter C. Some things that I think are helpful sometimes is I personally will get bogged down in the details with somebody. And I can get very frustrated with that. You know, if a guy comes to me at the mission who just comes with problem after problem after problem, and you're working on one and you're at a roadblock because of another one. Like, for instance, you know, they don't have any ID because they lost it all when they were out on the streets. And not only that, they don't have a birth certificate or a social security card anywhere. And their mom's dead, and their sister refuses to talk to them. So you can't even get a birth certificate with no ID, because you need someone to sign for it who has ID, but the sister won't sign for it. You know, and you have, you know, you just, everything, you know, there's a roadblock at every single spot. Well, they can't get the help they need, you know, at this medical place without their ID, and they can't, you know, they can't get a job without it. Well, you know, it's like one thing after another, and you just hit roadblock after roadblock, and I can get frustrated with that, and I can lose sight of the big picture, and I can get bogged down, you know, and then in sitting down and counseling this person, I can, you know, kind of feel a little just irritated with them, because their life's too messy and it's driving me nuts, you know. And something that is very, very helpful is to just step back and see the bigger picture. You know, one of the ways to help sort of sort through the complexities is just to remember the framework of creation, fall, and redemption. That all of life falls somewhere into those three categories, you know. For instance, the guy with the ID problem and the health problem and no job and all these, you know, addiction and all these other issues, well, his life falls under that all of his life falls under that framework of creation, fall, and redemption. He's a created being. He has physical needs. He has social needs and relational needs. He is created in the image of God, and there are creational needs. The fall happened. That's a no-brainer, right? That's like pretty obvious. Well, his life has gotten very twisted up and messed up as a result of the fall. There's his own sin mixed in the process, right? So there's his sin and the consequences of that. There's the sin of others against him, because, you know, he was abused as a kid, and you know, he was sexually abused by his birth father, and then you know, he was put into a foster home where he was also sexually abused there, and a place that was supposed to be a place of safety became a place of horror. And so then, you know, he ran away from there and started making all these awful choices and got involved in a life of drugs and prostitution and all this stuff. And you know, his life is messed up. Now, also as a result of that, he's got health issues as a result of his lifestyle. And so now, you know, the effects of sin and disease of being in a fallen world, that's affecting him too. All of creation, you know, is groaning with him. And then there's Satan. There's Satan out to seek and destroy him. He's got a lot of things working against him at this point. You know, and it's all because we live in a fallen world. But then there's redemption. And see, the cross of Christ actually deals with every single one of those areas. The cross is what takes the creation that groans and is going to glorify it. The cross is what takes my sin and offers forgiveness. The cross is what takes the sin of others against me and how I've been victimized. The cross is what offers hope for that, because I'll tell you what, in the end, all injustice is going to be dealt with one way or another, either because Christ already paid for it on the cross, or because the people perpetrating it will pay for it, you know, for all time. So there is no injustice left undealt with at the end, right? And the cross is also what defeats Satan. And so there's nothing in my life, in your life, in anyone's life who comes to our church doors, no matter how complicated, mixed up, messy, or screwed up, there is nothing in their lives that the cross does not directly address and deal with. And there's nothing that the cross doesn't inform us how to deal with as we come alongside that person and help them through it. the cross really is sufficient. And if we lose sight of that, it gets real complicated, and it gets real easy to just kind of follow these rabbit trails where you're constantly just like putting band-aids on and patching needs and trying to deal with crises one after another after another, and you're never really getting to help the person, you know, at the heart of the issue. So that's where I think kind of just stepping back and remembering the bigger picture, just having some simple categories to think about life and how we do life and where, you know, where we fit into the picture. Some simple categories can really help. They help us in dealing with people, and they also will help, you know, as we can, you know, pass these tools along to the folks in the pews that these are things that can help them make sense of life and can help give a little wisdom and direction and guidance to how it is that we need to help people. You know, it can help sort of make, you know, bring light into the confusion, you know, make a little stability out of the chaos and figure out where do we go from here. You know, just think of the bigger picture. Another one is this. You know, letter B under letter C under number two. People are people and hearts are hearts. You know, that's something that sometimes it's easy to forget. But it's true. Whether you're a resident of the Whosoever Gospel Mission, whether you are, you know, a Christian missionary in Mozambique, whether you are, you know, a professional who does mercy ministry at your church, and, you know, whoever you are people and hearts are hearts. There's nothing in your heart that's any more wicked or less wicked than the heart of any drug addict that comes to the mission. And it's nothing new, right? I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. There's no temptation that's overtaken you except that which is common to everybody. And so one of the temptations in dealing with the more extreme cases that come to us is to think, wow, this one's unique. I can't help them. This is bigger than anything I've ever seen. I don't even know where to start. Well, if I find myself thinking that, I know I've lost sight of the bigger picture, because I know that there's nothing unique to this person that hasn't been experienced and dealt with by saints through the scripture, by the church at large, by me, our own lives. There really is nothing that unique. It may play out in a million different ways, but the issues are all the same, you know. There's nothing new under the sun. People are people and hearts are hearts. Another thing to remember, you know, would be that we're not lone rangers. And not only are we not individually on our own in doing ministry, our church is not on its own either. You know, we're not an isolated enclave that has to do ministry within itself. The kingdom of God is huge, right? And he's doing things all over the world. And sometimes we can do incredible ministry in our churches, but where we can sometimes fall short is we sort of reinvent the wheel, and we put all this energy and effort and money and time and resources into something that somebody down the street is already doing. And they're part of the same kingdom, the same family, the same father, the same church. And yet we don't coordinate efforts, and we don't use them for what they have. I'll tell you, you know, pirate church organizations, they're just arms of the local church, right? And there's lots of good ones around partnering with them to let them do some of the more complicated things because they're set up to do it. I mean, no one church really has the resources to help every single person comprehensively and holistically, right? It's not there. But that's where there are resources for the church, like parachurch organizations, where the church can partner with them in support, and the church partners with them in volunteering and being a part of that. But that's a resource that the church has to say, you know what, you can go to the mission. Let me call them up, and I think they have a bed. We'll take you there. You know, that's a partnership. That's a resource. And so if we neglect those resources, boy, we're wasting an awful lot of energy trying to fix something that we don't need to do. We can connect them with something else. And that all that energy and effort could be used to help redirect other people to the resources that they need. You know, so that's a, you know, there's a lot of resources. I'd encourage you, if you haven't done this, or if your church hasn't done this, I'd encourage you to just create a resource file of ministries around that you can have on hand, that when a problem comes up, you know, you're not going to know every ministry intimately, but I'll tell you, when you got a problem and you go searching and you find one, you're going to get to know that ministry real quick because you need them, you know. Use the resources that are out there, but you can't use them if you don't know about them. You know, ignorance of what's out there is amazing. I mean, there's a lot of people don't know what's out there, and you won't know if you don't physically you know, talk to people and contact ministries and ask them for information, ask them to send you their contact information, their, you know, their admittance policies, things like that, where you can actually have resources on hand when somebody calls you and say, well, you know, I can't help you with that. However, why don't you come on in and let me see if I can't connect you with this person or this ministry. And you end up doing ministry by simply directing people to where they need to go. The church is large, and it's sometimes easy to forget that.
Okay, so you can motivate the church, right, by the whole, you know, idea that we're talking about loving God and loving others. You can equip them by, you know, continually walking alongside of them and trying to give them some tools for conceptualizing the problems of people and how to deal with them. You can help them to basically, you know, see the bigger picture and help them to use the resources that are around to be connected, to be able to stop and think broadly about, okay, what are the issues here and what do I know are the resources that we have that can help this person. You can do all those things. But since people are people and hearts are hearts, that includes us, it's easy to get discouraged, right? It's easy to lose stamina, to kind of lose steam, and to really kind of want to back off and back down and really sort of retreat into our own little corner of the world. And that's where this last point, this is a ministry that continues day in and day out and will continue day in and day out, both among the leadership and among the lay people. And that's a ministry of cheering the church on. You know, there's nothing about ministry that's inherently draining. And some people think that ministry must be draining. It's not. It's life. You know, it's loving God and loving others. What's draining about that? But I'll tell you what is draining is when we begin to focus on the work of the Lord. If we focus so much on the work of the Lord, you get totally overwhelmed, right? And you think, there's never enough time, there's never enough people to do it, there's never enough, you know, resources to help, and you get weary and you can get bitter and tired if you focus on the work of the Lord. However, if you focus on the Lord of the work, you are not drained, you are not tired, you are not, you know, burned out, you're not wasted. Because you realize if your focus is on the Lord of the work as opposed to the work of the Lord, you realize the bigger picture. You remember that, you know what, I'm never going to help every single poor or homeless person in Philadelphia, much less Pennsylvania or the country or the world. However, I am called to love my neighbor. I am called to live in relationship with the body of Christ and also those around me who are not part of the body. I'm called to do this thing called mercy ministry just because I'm called to love God and love others. And I can love God and love others because I never cease to be amazed and overwhelmed at the incredible and awesome mercy, love, and grace that God has poured out on me, that He's lavished on me. You know, there's not just this thing called adoption. God adopted me, right? There's not just this thing called justification. God justified me. You know, when you think about those things, you begin to be overwhelmed And you are, like Paul prayed in Ephesians 3, you begin to know what is the height and depth and width and length of the love of God for you, but you never know it fully because it can't be known, right? And as you are gripped by that, you're moved out of yourself to love God and love others. It becomes an expression of worship. It becomes a part of who you are. We're worshipers, right? We're all worshipers. We're always worshiping somebody or something. And if we focus on the Lord of the work, the focus of our worship becomes God. And when we live in worship to Him, it's a joy. And what does worship look like this side of glory? It looks like loving my neighbor as myself. Or beyond that, it looks like loving my neighbor as Christ has loved me. Laying down my life for my neighbor. Giving of myself for my neighbor. Taking risks for my neighbor. Being vulnerable. Being inconvenienced, you know, for my neighbor. And it doesn't become a tedious chore. Becomes a joy. It's invigorating because you get to see the gospel lived out. You get to see the grace of God at work in the lives of others. And the same way Paul talked about different believers as being his joy and his crown because he could see the grace of God worked out in their lives, we get to experience that too. That is also motivation to keep on pressing on. But we can easily lose sight of it. We can easily lose focus. And therefore, that's why God calls us that as long as it's called today,
We need to encourage one another. We need to point each other to the cross. And that's where we just keep on pointing to the cross. Again, you know, the cross dictates everything about how we do ministry, how we motivate others to do ministry. The cross tells us how to do it. It tells us why we do it. It gives us it empowers us to do it, right? Because on our own strength, who in the world can do this stuff, right? If left to ourselves, because we're petty, right? Our motivations are always mixed. You know, we're never, there's not a moment of the day when we're ever really loving God with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? It's always a mix. There's always me in there just popping up to just, you know, be evil. You know, it's like it's always there. So I don't have the power and the strength to do it, but the cross empowers me to do it because the cross tells me that I don't live out of my own righteousness. I have the very righteousness of Christ in me doing this and living this out. The righteousness of Christ in me empowers me to love others even when they in my own strength would just drive me nuts. So the cross is the motivation and the reason. The cross is what empowers me to do it. The cross is what equips me to do it and teaches me how to do it, because it demonstrates for me what love looks like. It demonstrates for me how to lay down my life for my friends and my enemies. It demonstrates for me what grace looks like, what mercy looks like. And part of encouraging and cheering the church on in mercy ministry is going to be saying, you know what? Not everyone is going to respond to you in gratitude. Matter of fact, let me know when they do, because that's kind of surprising and amazing and wow, just fun and encouraging. But if I think about mercy and grace, God did not pursue me because I was grateful. God did not pursue me because I was worthy of being pursued. He did not pursue me because I just had a really good attitude about my request for help, right? He didn't do, I mean, if that was the case, we'd all be damned forever, right? I mean, there'd be no hope. There'd be no hope. And so as I do ministry to others, let me not get offended when they don't approach me the right way, when they don't seem grateful, when they don't seem to appreciate all that I'm doing for them. How often do I appreciate all that God has done for me? You know, or do I take it for granted? Well, granted, I take it for granted sometimes. And you know what? People are going to take you for granted sometimes. Does it mean you don't do mercy ministry? Of course not. That's the attitude God took. We'd be in a heap of trouble. Now, doesn't mean that to love them, I'm not going to have to come alongside of them and say, hey, look, you know, look at these windows. You've opened these huge windows into your heart, and what I see is appalling, and I need to point this out to you in love because your attitude really sucks, you know. So you know, that may be what love looks like sometimes, but it doesn't mean I stop pursuing them, because God does not stop pursuing me. So the cross needs to motivate me in how I do ministry, in how I love others. And in doing it, I won't be recognized, you know. In doing it, I won't be appreciated. I won't be honored. I won't be, you know, the world will not see everything I'm doing and just bow down and worship me, which is what my heart wants, right? You know? And yet, even in the midst of all the turmoil that happens in our hearts when we realize that we're just being sort of petty and sinful, and then you can feel kind of guilty that you're being petty and sinful and think, well, I'm not really doing mercy ministry, this is all about me. And that's where you just step back and you look again to the cross. Because the cross tells me that even though I am more sinful than I could ever imagine, God chooses to use me in his kingdom for his glory to do mercy ministry. It's very ironic, you know, but it's neat. So that is something that we need to constantly encourage one another and also encourage the church to do. And then lastly, part of encouraging the church to press on, to keep moving on, and this is the same, I'll tell you, in our own personal lives, but also in the lives of those that we're doing ministry with, it's going to be learning to recognize and rejoice in the glory of what we would maybe think of as small victories. You know, sometimes when we look for success and we look for outcomes, we're looking for like these huge, glorious, grand things. We're looking for like drastic change. You know, we're looking for immediate turnaround. If we're helping a drug addict and you know, they seem to be doing well, and then they go and they relapse, and we think this, you know, like we just totally give up on them because we think they betrayed our trust and they betrayed all our help and they you know they've just gone back to their own sinful ways, their old ways, and so they don't really want my help. You know, well, wait a minute, when was the last time you relapsed, right, into your pride or your self-pity or your self-righteousness or your anger or this or that? Well, what's the difference, you know? And so sometimes we set expectations for people that we're ministering to that are so far above any of the expectations we set for ourselves, our own families, our own kids, our own church members, right? You know, when was the last time you relapsed into gossip or something, you know? Well, if that was the case, you know, if we judged ourselves and treated ourselves and evaluated ourselves on the same basis that we often treat these really messy people that come to us for help, we'd all be kicked out of the church, right? So I think one thing to remember is that the whole process of sanctification that we experience throughout the whole course of our lives, we shouldn't expect it to be different or more drastic in the people that we're ministering to than it is in ourselves. So recognizing victory and recognizing the grace of God at work in somebody may mean rejoicing with them that when they went out and relapsed, they came back the next day instead of coming back a month later after using Vindic for the whole month. Well, that's a victory. Am I glad they relapsed? No. But you know what? As sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And God will redeem even the consequences of our sin and our sin for his glory and our good. So if we don't functionally believe that as we minister to others, then we're missing half the gospel. Actually, we're missing the whole thing. So I would just encourage you, as you train others to do ministry, talk about what your expectations are and talk about what they're not. And when things do not necessarily look like they've gone, you know, perfect or great, just step back and think, well, wait a minute, what has God done here? Is there something that I can see and rejoice in? Is there some growth that I can see, something that I can give God glory for? Because, you know, he's the one making us righteous. He's the one making, and I'll say the same promise to make you righteous is the same promise to make anyone righteous that comes to your door for help, they're a believer. And so if I don't see God working, then I'm missing something, because God doesn't really fail at what he does. So if he promises that he's going to continue to conform them into the image of Christ, if I'm not seeing that happening, then I'm missing something. And so we need to become experts at recognizing and just rejoicing in the glorious victories that aren't necessarily the big ones that we're looking for, but they're just as glorious. And that's one way that we can encourage each other and not be disheartened in ministry that we're doing. And it's also real important for the people we're ministering to see those victories too, because they need to see God at work as well, and God needs to be glorified for it. Well, any discussion, comments, questions, criticisms? Any thoughts?
We're gonna have a Q&A in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Just hold that.
All right, we'll hold that. Well then, that's about what I wanted to share. Just the big things. Just remember the bigger picture. You know, it's really not complicated. Complex, yes. Complicated, no. The gospel is simple, not to be confused with simplistic, but it is simple. And if we forget that, then we're forgetting something huge. And sometimes you need to just step back and just remember the bigger picture that, wait a minute, if I think that this problem is too complicated and too big and too complex for us to deal with, then I really need to step back, because I know that there's nothing unique to this person that's, you know, unique from all of Christendom and all the resources of the gospel to help. Because there's nothing new under the sun. There's no temptation that's overtaken us except that which is common to man. And God has given me the resources within the body of Christ to minister his grace effectively to this person in this situation. So maybe I need to step back and do some hard looking at the gospel to see how the gospel does apply. But I guarantee you the gospel does apply to the situation.